You are listening to Oscar Conversion Therapy Survivor. The Oscar series is aimed at busting myths around queer topics and bringing you the realities faced by people who have actually experienced them. My name is Sheena. My pronouns are she, her, and I am joined today by two amazing guests who are doing a no-holds-barred discussion about conversion therapy and their experiences. Today I'm joined by Elena Joy. Thank you for joining me, Elena.
Thank you so much for having me. I am a speaker and a founder of a nonprofit and a mom of four beautiful kids and, yeah, and a lesbian. And my pronouns are she, her, and I am a conversion therapy survivor, so hence I am enjoying being on your program.
And I'm joined by Ray D. Magden. Ray, thank you for joining me today.
Hello, I'm Ray D. Magden. My pronouns are she, her. I'm an author of 10 books with the label Desert Palm Press. My latest release is Lucky Seven, which is a cyberpunk novel about a whole crew of queer characters taking down evil corporations with virtual heists. And it won a Golden Crown Literary Award and a Rainbow Award. So I'm really happy to be here today.
Fantastic. All right, so let's talk about your survival story. What did you do to get through it? How it affected your relationships? And what are the tricks and tools that got you through? Ray, you start.
One of the most important things I had to do in order to get through this period of my life was to reach out to other queer people and other support systems in my life, because my faith community and my parents were letting me down. They weren't giving me the support I needed. And it was embarrassing to convince myself that I needed to ask for help because, you know, as women, we are taught to serve, to take care of others' needs, to put our own needs aside. Also, there was some embarrassment because, you know, I wasn't getting kicked out of my home. I wasn't getting hit. And so I thought, well, my situation isn't that bad. I don't really have a right to be upset or traumatized because other people have been through so much worse. But I had to put that aside and remind myself that it's not a suffering competition and that I was worthy of help. So I made queer friends online because I was the only out person at my school. And I went to a secular therapist, which I'm very privileged that I was able to access that. And I read a lot of queer fiction as well. And that really sustained me because my faith community and my family told me that if you're queer, you can't be happy. You're just going to be miserable. It's impossible to find some kind of fulfillment or happiness when you're this way. And that feeds into the narrative of brokenness they feed you in conversion therapy. But I was able to counteract that message with stories about lesbian and sapphic heroes, queer women who fell in love and saved the world. And that showed me that things could be different, and it helped me stick around. And I'm really glad I did, because now I have the privilege of writing those stories for other people who might need them.
How old were you when this was going on?
I realized I was queer when I was 12. I mean, there were inklings before, but I didn't have the language to process it. I started dating my best friend, who at the time identified as female, when I was 14. We were 14. And then I was outed an overheard phone conversation when I was 16. And that at that time, I had to start attending meetings with my priest. So I was still a minor. I was still completely financially and emotionally dependent on my parents.
And you hadn't finished high school yet.
I hadn't finished high school yet. So I'm lucky that my parents didn't, you know, disown me or kick me out, but it was a very real fear, even though later they expressed disappointment that I had even thought they were capable of that.
What did your therapist make of all of this while it was happening?
My therapist, you know, she was really great. She's part of the reason I'm still around for sure. But I don't think I remember talking to her too much about the sessions with the priest, because I guess I thought it was normal. I didn't recognize it as part of the problem, as part of the thing that was damaging my mental health so much. I think I was probably in my sessions talking more about my classmates and school, because when you're a teenager, that stuff is so important in your mind. I don't think I even recognized how bad the damage was from those meetings until I was much older. I know that my therapist did encourage my mother to go to a secular therapist so she could work through her issues, which she did, which is very unusual. I haven't heard many other queer people with that story where their parent went to a secular therapist as well.
Her issues with regards to your sexuality?
Yes.
And she actually did that?
Yes, she did.
And even so, you were sent to your priest?
Well, I was sent to my priest first, and then later, a couple months later, my mom was convinced to see a therapist herself, a secular one, which she did. And I don't know exactly what happened in those therapy sessions, but a few months after that, I was taken out of conversion therapy meetings. So I have to assume that my therapist and the secular therapist did convince her that it wasn't a good idea to put me in those situations. It wasn't a formal version of conversion therapy like a camp or something. It was, I just had to go talk to my religious leader and was basically told over and over again that I was broken and that I needed to be heterosexual. But at the same time, if I was queer, that I couldn't act on it and I had to be celibate. And it was a whole thing.
So how immersed were you with the queer online culture at the time?
That was my whole life, basically. That was my...
So you'd escape into that space because you felt safe there?
Yes, absolutely. That was my safe space. And that those were the people who understood me.
So really, if you hadn't had that community, you would have been completely alone?
Yes, absolutely. They were all I had, except for obviously my therapist was also a big point of support. But I have no idea what I would have done if I had been born and come out before the age of the internet, because really that was my lifeline.
What was happening with your partner during all of this? Were you still together?
Yeah, we were. We got together at 14 and stayed together ever since. I know that he was very concerned about me and very angry at my parents. I think sometimes he's still angry at my parents. I mean, I know I've said this in a previous podcast, but my partner's a trans man, so he got to see them react to several coming outs on both our parts. And, you know, I think he saw how stressed it made me and how damaged it made me. And he and my parents get along somewhat now, but there's still some distance. And, you know, that's a whole other thing. I mean, then there's other people in your life who resent your parents or whoever sends you to conversion therapy. The rest of my extended family, like my aunts and uncles and cousins and one of my grandmothers, were very upset when they found out that this was going on. And my mom faced some alienation from her family. They sided with me, which was, I didn't tell them to side with anyone, but they sided with me. And I think she had some embarrassment at that point as well.
Did that make you feel guilty as well for splitting up the family?
It did, actually. I should have felt maybe a little bit vindicated, like, oh, the family's on my side. But really, I just thought, oh, crap, now my mom is really upset and it's my fault. We have this thing where we try to blame ourselves for everything that's going on, even if it's not necessarily our fault. And that's a habit that carries on into adulthood if you're not careful.
When you're a 16-year-old and you're in the company of an adult who you trust and who leads the community, who's telling you you've done things wrong, there's something wrong with you that you need to be fixed, of course you're going to believe that person and take it to heart. And so therefore, everything that comes out of that situation is going to also be, it's your fault.
I am grateful, though, because while I blamed myself then, looking back now, that's extra reassurance when I need it to know, oh, my extended family thought this was messed up too.
What's the time frame on this? So you're 16, you're in conversion therapy. When does your family find out?
The rest of my family? Oh, not for a couple years later.
Oh, so you were out of
Yeah, I was out of high school by then when the rest of my family found out and said, wow, that's messed up that that happened. That's messed up that your parents don't accept you. It really came to a head at my wedding, actually, because my mom didn't attend. And they're like, why isn't your mom coming? Doesn't she accept you? Because neither of us really talked to anyone else in the family about it. And I said, well, actually, no. And I explained some of our history. And that's when the rest of the family was like, oh, no, this isn't good. So, and then there were some issues between my mother and the rest of her biological family on her side and my dad's side.
So was everybody blaming your mother?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? I find that interesting. I find it interesting that they blame her, even though my dad is supposedly an equal co-parent and therefore equally culpable. And I know both of my parents love me and they were doing this out of what they thought was love. But I find it interesting that he didn't experience that kind of partial shunning from the family. And I wonder if gender dynamics played into that.
I wouldn't be surprised, but I can't. I mean, I don't know your family, so I can't comment. But what was your romantic relationship like throughout all of this? Did you get closer? Did it get stronger? Did you break up? Like, because there's a lot going on.
Actually, it got stronger, which seems a little odd. You'd think that it would really damage your romantic relationships to be put in conversion therapy if you are in a supposedly same gender relationship when you're going to conversion therapy. You'd think it would make it so much worse. But for me, it brought us closer because I had this stable, loving relationship when I was very young that I was so blessed to have. And then it was so contrary to all of the things that were being told to me. And I couldn't reconcile it. I couldn't reconcile it how this wonderful, nurturing, loving, caring, healthy relationship was bad, like my priest and my faith community and my parents were telling me. I could not reconcile the two, and it really made me question everything else I was hearing. Because I was living openly as a queer person at the time that I was put in therapy. And my two worlds were not reconciling. So one of them had to be wrong.
Okay. Elena.
So my experience was attending conversion therapy as an adult. As we've kind of gone over, I was 37, I think, when I started. Yeah, 37, 38 when I finished. I was married at the time to a man. We had been married 17 years at that point, and I was doing it out of desperation to save the marriage. I very much had a core belief that divorce was failure, and I wouldn't accept failure into my life. And so we really, when I say we, I mean myself and my husband and my religious leader, we really attacked this same-sex attraction as Elena had a momentary lapse of indiscretion. And Elena's not really gay. It's just that she was experiencing a lot of emotion, and there was this woman in her life that offered her friendship, and it just went off the rails. But we're really just going to focus on getting this marriage back on track. That was really kind of the strategy that we went through it. And at first, it wasn't conversion therapy. At first, it was just marriage therapy. And we went and saw this older woman of our faith, and she had been recommended by like dozens of people. Oh, she saves everyone's marriage. Like, that's who you go to. And we went to her quite a few times, and she eventually requested an appointment with just me. And the topic of the conversation was, don't you ever tell your children that you had this affair and that you have this attraction towards women. And she proceeded to tell me about many of the clients that she has now as adults whose parents had come out to them as kids, and they are now dysfunctional adults. And it was because their parents had come out to them when they were kids, and it ruined their lives. And if I wanted to prevent that for my children, I was told to never come out to them, never tell them what happened. The healthiest path forward would be to never come out to my children and to never let them know that this affair had happened. And it was an affair. We had become best friends. And for a very brief amount of time, it had become physical. I think like 3 weeks before my husband found out. I was not very good at hiding anything. I'm not good at lying in most cases. And then when I was trying to hide something, yeah, that didn't work out very well. I left a very clear trail of breadcrumbs. So it was a brief affair. And this therapist, fully licensed therapist, said, don't you ever come out to your children. And I will remember for the rest of my life standing up at the end of that session to leave. And she stood up as well. And she looked me in the eye and she said, if your children are your priority, you will take this secret to your grave. And that, I did not know at the time, but that became very pivotal. That became a moment of, okay, if my kids are going to never know, if I'm never going to have that relationship and that kind of love, and my kids are never going to know, I might as well stay in this marriage. Right? It became, okay, my options are the grave or keeping this secret for the rest of my life. And a divorce will damage my children. I was absolutely convinced of that. And so that kind of upped the ante. And that became, okay, well, then I'm going to stay in this marriage and I'm going to keep this secret for the rest of my life. And maybe that'll be less hard if I can fix it somehow. So hence when a friend was like, yeah, I know a guy, I know a therapist who helps with this. He's a great guy. So of course I jumped into it with both feet. I called him, I set an appointment. I remember meeting him for the first time. He was an older gentleman, in my faith. He just seemed knowledgeable and caring. And he truly did care about my family and he wanted our marriage to work because I was presenting to him that I wanted the marriage to work because nothing else was an option. What were my options? The grave? Like, I didn't have anything else. So I really wanted that marriage to work. And I look back now and I think, wow, I didn't Google it. I didn't even Google him. I didn't check out his background at all. Neither did my husband and neither did my religious leader who was fully supportive of me going. None of us looked into the concept of can homosexuality be cured, quote unquote. None of us, like literally I gave more attention to the bath towels I bought on Amazon last week than I did regarding this therapy. Like I didn't read any reviews, like nothing. There was no critical thinking skills happening whatsoever. And so it was a challenge to find reality, right? Like Ray said, having these two worlds collide and the logic of one does not work out in the logic of the other world, right? So one of them has to be faulty logic. And it was a massive process to figure out where is the faulty logic? Is it in me? Because all of these authority figures are telling me it's in me. The brokenness is in me. So every time you start to doubt something or you start to question something, it starts within you. I mean, there's a huge phrase in the religion, doubt your doubts before you doubt your faith. And so if you have questioning doubts in your head, like that's from evil. That's from the devil. Like you're supposed to doubt those doubts before you give any credence to them, to think about them and to question what's going on around you or what's going on with you. So that's where I was. And then to take that into a survival story, I feel like just like with Ray, it's very multi-leveled. And I do agree. Like I think the advent of social media, the advent of online communities has increased access for all of us. It was literally my first realization that lesbians can be healthy people was literally searching the hashtag on Instagram, lesbian moms. And I saw these lesbian women, like, being healthy, functional parents and partners and humans. And it was, I was 38 years old when I did that search. And it was mind-blowing to me that that community existed, let alone was flourishing and strong. And it was mind-blowing. And so that was so good for me. And then it was literally a path of just continually being inspired and things being put in my hands and relationships. I got referred to this real therapist, and it turned out she was this incredibly powerful, functional, married woman to another woman. Like, I landed in her office without knowing any of that. And it was absolutely incredible to kind of be mentored by her and for me to be able to ask all those questions. I'm not kidding you guys. Last week when we did the interview and you guys brought up the term TERF, I had no idea what you guys were talking about. And I didn't want to Google it because sometimes the search results can be iffy. So I brought it into my therapist and I was like, they were talking about TERFs. What is that? And luckily we were able to have a great discussion and I learned a lot. And I'm so grateful that she's in my life because I can ask her questions like that. You know, I think I talked about the entire first season of The L Word with her because I was like, I had so many questions. I didn't understand so much of it. And now, of course, she wants me to watch Orange is the New Black. And I'm like, I don't know if I can deal with that. But she's been really helpful in helping me feel normal and feel like I really am just another person, even though I feel so odd in my community, but she normalizes it for me quite a bit. I have to be on meds, and as I think a lot of people are, right? I mean, especially in this time, people who weren't anxious 2 months ago are highly anxious now, and people who were anxious 2 months ago are like crazy anxious, and we're surrounded by all these people that didn't used to have anxiety, but now they do. Like, it's a rough time right now, and so I really prioritize my self-care. The biggest way that I climbed out of the pit that I was in was I embraced self-awareness. I journal pages and pages every day, and I meditate every single day. It started as I had to prove to the judge during the divorce proceedings that even though, yes, I had had suicidal ideations, that I was still a fit mom, so that my kids didn't get taken away from me. And so it started in that way. My therapist was like, I have to submit all of my notes to the judge. So let's do everything. We'll take all the meds and we'll do the meditation and the journaling and take walks every day. Like, I was like, I don't care. I'll do whatever you want. I just want to keep my kids. And so that's what started it. And then it turned out to be absolutely life-changing and incredible for me, transformational for me. To be able to use self-awareness to realize, oh, I judge everything. Like, there's a reason why I was such a conservative, uptight, like, really mean person. Because I was judging everything around me because I was judging everything within me. I was judging every meal that I had, every book that I read, every movie that I watched, the clothes that I put on my body. Like, everything was a good versus bad mentality, very binary. So being able to become aware of that and release that judgment is, it's a daily process, and it's a transformational process for me that I absolutely needed. And I don't know, you know, when you say survival story, I have to not look at it like that. I survived that year, and I've survived the past year. And right now, at this time, I'm taking it a day at a time. And like what Ray said, reaching out to others is really damn hard. And we're so separate right now. I mean, even just last night, I was on Instagram. My anxiety has been through the freaking roof lately. and I'm so sick of taking pills, and I've been meditating like 4 times a day, and like I'm doing like all the things I'm supposed to do, sunshine and vitamin D and all the things, journaling, meditating, going on walks, doing all the things, and still at midnight last night, I was still pacing around my couch, and I posted something on Instagram, like, is anyone else up? Because this is insane. And yes, my community reached back, and I felt loved and supported, and still, 15 minutes later, I deleted the post, because it was humiliating to admit that that's where I was. Still, you know, I put myself out there as this very emotionally intelligent person, but I think the humility comes from knowing it's not, the journey isn't over. I haven't victoried over anything. I victoried over yesterday. That's it. Today is still another, I'm not going to say battle, but strategy. I still have to use a strategy today to get through today. And I think everyone is like that, right? I don't think that's just me. I think that's a lot of people in our world.
Thank you for being an awesome listener and supporting Tilt, the channel that brings you all the podcasts you want to hear. You're listening to Tilt. Find more podcasts on thelesbiantalkshow.com.
You might not be able to say it's going to be easy, but you will get stronger. And I mean that to you, Elena, but I also mean that to everyone else. I mean, this is a process. It isn't going to just be better one day magically, but you will get stronger and you will learn better ways to cope and better ways to care for yourself. I'm really happy that you mentioned medication, because that's part of my self-care strategy too. If I had not been medicated, I was medicated when I was 12. So, I mean, I needed pretty hardcore antidepressants, and I still do. And there's shame that comes with that, but it's important. It's a really important part of being healthy for some people, and you just got to do it. You don't always like it, but you got to do it.
And have you guys found there's a really interesting cross-section? I have people in my life that they don't want to address the homosexuality. They don't even want to really talk about that. They barely ask about my girlfriend, like, even though it's like obviously uprooted my life a little bit in the last 4 years. But what they will talk about is like, oh, you seem depressed, or oh, you seem anxious, or how's it going with your doctor these days? Like, it's almost like they're more willing to address the mental illness than they will celebrate the love and the happiness that I have found. It's almost like they'd rather wallow in the challenge than celebrate the victory.
Oh, yeah. My parents are like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, they have a really hard time celebrating anything to do with my queerness.
Yeah.
But they're always there for support when I'm having mental health issues. So I completely understand where you're coming from. It's weird, huh?
Elena, let's go a couple of steps back. Were you raised in the Mormon church?
No, I was not raised. Funny enough, my mom and dad are from Connecticut. I'm in Arizona. And they are from Connecticut, and they met when my dad was on leave from the Coast Guard. My mom was raised very Catholic, like went to Catholic school, nuns, the whole thing. My dad was raised very Episcopalian. His dad was the leader of the local Masonic lodge, et cetera, et cetera. So when they met, the parents were irate. They were so upset. And there was serious religious drama. One grandfather wasn't even going to attend the wedding, finally did. It was ridiculous. And then they had 2 kids, and it was still religious drama, 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 drama. And so they moved out west. They literally left and went across the country to get away from the religious drama. And then I was born. And then when I was 16, I joined the Mormon church. And they were like, wait, what? Like, what are you doing? We moved across the country to get away from this stuff. So they are, And yet at the same time, like, I was 16 years old and telling them I wanted to join a church that was telling me to not have sex and to not do drugs and to not drink, to be a very good person, right? Like, what parent is going to say no to that? And especially when you have a 16-year-old girl, you're definitely picking your battles. Like, I get that now. Like, that's not a battle that they were going to pick. So I have taken my parents on a roller coaster. There's no doubt. Like, jumping into this very conservative, very high demand religion, which caused me to, like, they weren't able to attend my wedding. Like, there were so many things that were taken from them by me going into that religion. And then jumping out of it the way I did by coming out as homosexual, I've really taken them on a whirlwind. That's for sure.
So how religious were you brought up?
Well, not very, because they really had conflicting ideas. And then once they came out west, my mom really started looking into more of a new age spirituality. I was raised with, where my mom was concerned, like, we had crystals in the house and we saw healers and Reiki healers. And so kind of a blend of Catholic, but I was also confirmed when I was 12 or whatever that was. So kind of a blend of very Catholic, but also very New Age.
And then you chose your new religion and you jumped into it and you got married and had children.
Correct.
But now this is however many years later, you've very much a part of that community and your faith is strong. And then you meet a woman who becomes your best friend.
Yeah.
Okay, so I wish listeners could see your face when I said that, because just the smile erupts. Okay, so that's what I want to talk about now. You met a woman and this changed everything for you.
Yeah, it did. It changed my whole life. I mean, I can look back and I can see where the slide was starting. You know, I had been in a marriage for 17 years that was not intimate. It was not satisfaction based. It was not equal in that way. And so I could see that there was a slide before I met her, years before I met her. I was starting to really lose it because I was being told that I was important. Like, my husband couldn't get into heaven without me either. So I must be important as a woman. And yet, not a lot was done or even worried about the fact that I was not happy. It was, go fix it, Elena, like, figure out a way to fix it. And I did try. We had been married like 3 years. We had had one kid and it had taken 3 years to get pregnant with our first. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, I was pregnant with our second. And my mother told me, my mother, who was not Mormon, told me in an offhand conversation, boy, Elena, I hope you're getting to orgasm now, because if you have a bunch of Mormon kids, yeah, like, you're not going to figure that out. So figure that out before you have a bunch of kids. And I took that really seriously. I was like, oh, okay. Like, I'm now pregnant with my second, and there's only going to be 21 months between them. Like, I've got to figure this out. And so when you're Mormon and you have a question about life in general, you go to your bishop. And I'm like, I don't think this physical thing is working out with us. And he looks at my husband. He's like, well, what do you think? And he's like, I'm good. And he's like, okay, well, the problem is you, Elena. Maybe you should go get some counseling. And we were at Brigham Young University going to school. And so counseling was free if you went with the student therapist, right? So that's where I went. And I've thought about it since then, because that poor woman, this poor young therapist, I'm sure all of her textbooks told her that in this situation, you have to instruct the young woman to masturbate and figure out what makes her happy so that she can tell her partner what makes her happy. But when you're Mormon, that's not allowed. So what strategy do you have? So we met for 4 months and basically accomplished nothing. And then that was my idea of therapy, was, oh, nothing changes. It's a waste of time and money. So I didn't go back to therapy until all of this happened.
So just to clarify, Mormons are not allowed to masturbate.
Oh, no. No, 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 no.
So, okay. So you're supposed to figure out what's wrong with your sex life, but you, not your husband, he's not at all responsible because he's fine.
He's fine. That's right. So but the problem is
you can't masturbate to figure out what you like.
That's correct. And you bet you cannot, like, Google it, right? Because you're going to come across porn, and porn is bad, 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 bad. So your resources are your bishop, and that's about it.
Now we get to 4 kids down the line, 17 years of marriage, you meet a woman.
Right. So at this point, I have 4 kids, and my kids, my youngest has gone off to kindergarten. And so I have 6 hours a day to think for myself. Mind blowing. And it was then that I recognized, oh, I'm not happy. I'm not satisfied. I'm not even sure of who I am anymore. And so that's kind of common, right? To get into your 30s and your kids have gone off to school and you don't really recognize yourself anymore. Okay, that makes sense. So I'm going to do a lot, like I'm going to start working out, because that was one thing in my life that I could control, was my body, what I did with my body, what I took into my body. And I really gleaned onto that control. And I started running. I started long distance running. I loved it because it closed all the tabs in my brain and I just could be in my body. One of the very interesting power moves of this church is that when you go through the temple and you get sealed for time and all eternity, you're also endowed with, you make these covenants with God, covenants that you're going to live the law of chastity, that you're going to be as Christ-like as you possibly can. Nothing shocking, but all these covenants that you're making with God. And in return, you're given blessings. And one of those blessings is to wear what's called temple garments, or people know them as like the magical Mormon underwear. And they're these undergarments that you wear 24/7, and they ensure modesty because the bottoms go down to your knees. And so you're never going to wear like short shorts or short skirts. And then the top has like a cap sleeve. And so you're never going to wear like a tank top or a sleeveless shirt or dress or anything. And they're supposed to be worn all the time. Unless you are bathing or having sex, you are wearing those garments. And so you become very disconnected from your body. I mean, I literally went 17 years without ever really seeing my body or connecting with my body until I started those workouts, until I started the running. And I was so bad because I took my garments off to work out because it's horrible working out in those things. And that started the process of like reconnecting with my body again and remembering what it felt like to be in my body and not disengaged from my body. So I'm telling all of this because this is kind of the lead up into, so here I was in this mental and physical space of, okay, maybe rediscovering myself or maybe getting to know myself again, but also regrounding myself in my body and reengaging in my body. And starting to realize, wow, I really kind of liked myself. I liked who I was. I liked that I was really strong. I could deadlift a whole lot. And I liked that I could run half marathons. And that I could learn new skills. And so I decided to take on a new hobby, one that was very meditative, because I really liked that state of flow. And it was fly fishing. So I started learning fly fishing, and I went to a fly fishing club. It was in an Elks Lodge on like a Tuesday night, and there were like 150 old men and maybe 6 women. And it was so cool because it was the first time I was able to hang out with other fly fishers and talk fish. And I loved it and talk gear and all the stuff. And there was a break in the meeting and there's a board, like a president and a vice president and stuff. And there was a woman, one woman that served on the board. And all the guys on the board were like, go introduce yourself to the new girl. And she was like, no, just because I'm another woman? And they're like, yes, go do it. And she got really angry because the only reason she was talking to me was because of her gender. So she wanted to say something to me that would totally offend me, so she'd never have to talk to me again. And so she came over and she said, "Well, I guess only boobs can talk to other boobs, so hi." And I laughed my ass off, and she was like, "Oh, no." So we chatted fishing, and I got her phone number, and a few days later, I texted her and asked if she would take me fishing. I had heard her name for a while amongst the groups. She was the only young woman fly fisher in Arizona, but she was also the best female fly fisher in Arizona over everyone, and one of the best fishers in general. Like, she was, and I had heard, like, if you can go fishing with Kristen, you need take advantage because she'll teach you a lot. So when I heard that that's who I was talking to, I definitely made a plan right away that I would get her to take me fishing. So that's how it started.
It's like a romance novel.
Yeah, she's in the other room working.
Wait, are you still with her now?
Yeah.
Wow, that's incredible. That's so sweet.
All right, so then you guys get together for a very brief period before you decide you're going to try make a marriage work.
Yeah.
What is her feelings on this whole thing? What's going on between the two of you during this?
So, interestingly, if my husband had just not checked my phone for probably like another 3 or 4 days, our relationship probably would have ended. We were on that path. It was very hard for her. We were in love, and it was very hard for her to see how I was being treated, how I was jumping through hoops. It was killing her. And so she was trying to end things, and I was basically pleading, like, you are the only source of happiness in my life. You can't leave me. And yet I never, ever suggested anything like, so I'll leave my husband, or I'll walk away, or... because that wasn't going to happen. Again, divorce is failure. So I was really putting both of us in a really hard position. And the night Chad found out, we were up all night. And I knew she drove to work at like 5 a.m. And so I called her at 5 a.m. with Chad sitting on the bed watching me. And I had to say, Chad found out, and I'm never going to see you again. And goodbye. So we didn't talk from that moment until probably 5 months. She has the days. We call them the dark ages. we didn't exist to each other. And there was no form of closure. There was no real goodbye. Like, it was just pretty traumatic. And what ended up happening was, here I was enmeshed in the conversion therapy. And luckily, on meds at that point, I was finally able to sleep. I was starting to think clearly. I was starting to question what was going on around me. And I decided I really need closure. I was starting to get an inkling that this marriage might not work out. And I might end up at the end of this without Chad, possibly without God, and I'm probably without Kristen. And I knew she was contemplating moving out of the state, and so I needed closure. I needed to say goodbye. And so my husband agreed, as long as a mutual friend chaperoned the meeting. And we met at her house, at our friend's house, and we each had things we wanted to say to each other to say goodbye. And it was only supposed to be like an hour, and it turned into like 3. We were crying a lot. There was a lot of tears and snot. And then I had to go. I had my daily therapy appointment. And so we were driving out of the neighborhood. She was in her car behind me. And as we were driving out of the neighborhood, I was thinking about how it went. And I realized our chaperone, our mutual friend, had been texting the whole time. And so I called Kristen. I could see her pick up the phone behind me in the car. And I was like, do you think she was texting Chad? And Kristen was like, oh, I know she was. I saw her phone. Like, she was texting him the whole time. And then I was like, want to go to lunch? She was like, hell yeah, I do. So that was kind of the beginning of the end. Like, that was when I started really differentiating between away from everyone. Like, my identity is now not housed as a wife or even as a friend or even as a community member. I'm starting to claim Elena. And it was that situation that kind of forced that to happen, because I realized the only person I can depend on is myself, period, period. So, yeah. So she, yeah.
So she didn't actually know that the conversion therapy was happening?
No, she knew I was seeing this guy, and he was helping me work through traumatic stuff in my past. That's what she knew. And she Googled him. She looked up reviews about him and saw that he had been mentioned in the papers quite a few times, and that he had deliberately let his license lapse because he didn't want to risk that. So she knew a lot more about him than I did. And interestingly as well, like, once I filed for divorce, we did not move in together. Like, we needed a time to just date because we had never done that, right? So we had this time, about a year, that we just did the dating thing. And in that time, she was like, okay, well, if Elena is going to be Mormon, I just want to be with Elena. And if that's where she's going to be on Sundays, then I'm going to look into this and figure this out and see what there is with this. Okay, when you Google Mormonism, you find out a lot of things. And so she very quickly realized, oh, it's a cult. I'm not going to be involved in that. But she did not say anything to me, anything at all. She completely let me figure out my own spiritual path. And so months later, when I very much had an answer from God that I did not need to be in this religious framework in order to feel loved, that's when she was like, okay, well, just so you know, this is what's going on with the church, because I hadn't been in like a year, and this is what they're teaching your kids, and these are the new rules regarding homosexuals, and that it's been very helpful, because my kids are still very much involved in the church, but it's very, very hard for me to even go on their website, to even talk about the rules. And she doesn't have that trigger, and so she is able to stay very up to date with what they're being taught, and she is able to interact with them regarding their activities, and she's able to stay more neutral than me. I have a really hard time staying neutral with it.
So you had to negotiate that with your kids? Because I had to have that negotiation with my mom about how much I wanted to hear about her faith life and how much
right
she wanted to hear about my queerness and the various activities related to that.
Mm-hmm.
When I say activities, I mean like book conferences and stuff, not like all the awesome queer sex I'm having. I wouldn't tell my mom about that anyway. No. But
I feel like more people need to know about the awesome queer sex. Yeah. I do.
No joke. That's a huge part of one of my talks that I give to faith transitioning conferences, is I talk about the fact that how disengaged I got from my body and how no one literally told me in my entire life, you deserve good sex. That's important to your life. You deserve it. And now I tell the audience that right from the stage, you deserve great sex. And so do your kids. So damn it, start talking to them about it.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Queer sex tends to be better sex. It just is a fact.
It really is. It really is.
Okay. What would you say to somebody who's going through this right now?
You are going to have to get over the hump of asking for help and find somebody that you can really trust. And that won't be easy. It's really difficult. But you can't go through this alone. You just can't. And the good news is you don't have to, because there are so many other people out there who have been through the exact same thing. And it's really tragic that so many of us have been through it. But also, it means that you're not alone. There are other people who have had these experiences who can help you, who can listen, who can advise, who can just stand as examples of happy people who happen to be queer. So, you know, we're all in this together. And do whatever you can to find that community. And it's going to be, most of it's going to be online. I wish that wasn't so. I wish there were more groups in person, because there is something to that. You know, just being able to physically be in the same space as someone. But at the same time, the internet really is a blessing, because it puts us in touch with this wonderful community who wants to help. You are not a burden. We want to help, and we will help if you just take that little step to ask.
And then it will be your joy in a year from now, or 3 years from now, or 10 years from now, to turn around and help others.
Exactly, yes.
And it will go so far in your own healing. And so accepting that help right now is a big deal. And as well as sacrificing the pride, right? Sacrificing the ego to say, I'm hurting right now. And letting other people say, that's not okay with me. Like, I'm thinking about Ray's aunts and uncles and cousins, the ones who were able to communicate to her, it's not okay with me that you experienced that. That is so affirming. And I think so many people don't realize that as damaging as words can be, that's how healing words can be as well. Like, there's an equilibrium there. And so when you're able, when allies are able to speak up and say, it's not okay with me that you went through that, I'm really sorry. And other queer people to say, I know how not okay that was. And maybe I didn't experience that, but I know that it's so damaging. And it's not okay with me that you experienced that. Oh my gosh, it's so healing for you and for them.
So if you are going through something, please reach out, because no one wants to see you hurt yourself. It's not the answer.
No, in fact, the biggest thing that helped me when I was in that moment was my good friend said to me, you think taking your own life will stop the pain, but it doesn't. It only spreads it around. And so the thought of me being gone and then my children carrying that pain that I was feeling without me there to comfort them, absolutely not. Like, that is what saved me. The meds keep saving me every day. But that thought of, I will not let my children feel this pain that I'm feeling right now, that kept me here.
That was very true for me too. The thought that my partner, who is now my spouse, my parents, even though they were partially the cause of my pain, they didn't mean to hurt me, and they loved me and I loved them. And knowing how it would hurt them, my brother, my extended family, my friends, thinking about all the people who loved me and wanted me to be there was really, it sounds a bit trite because that's always what they tell you when you have suicidal ideation. Think of the people who love you. But I mean, there are people who love you. Even when you feel like there aren't, there are, I guarantee you, people who love you and who want you to stay.
And who need you to stay.
Who need you to stay.
Yeah.
And you might not have even met some of those people yet.
Exactly.
So if you're truly feeling alone, keep in mind the people that you need to stick around for, they might not even be in your life yet.
That's right.
I can't even imagine how bereft I would be if I'd never gotten to meet my best friend, who I didn't meet till I was in my 20s. So stick around. I promise it's worth it.
All right, so we're going to talk about media, books, things that touched you personally and that you want to recommend to others.
Yes. Go ahead, Ray.
Okay, well, I mean, the stuff that was so important to me is kind of dated now. I mean, there's better stuff out there now than the stuff that I was clinging to, and that's why I got into content creation. But I will say that one of the books that I read over and over and over again was Annie on My Mind. That's a classic published in the 1980s, I believe, or was it the 90s? But either way, it's one of the OG lesbian fiction books. It's about a teenage girl coming out and going through a lot of the same stuff I went through, and it was just so validating to read that I wasn't alone. So there was that.
You're involved in a couple of fandoms right now. What are they?
Okay, well, the fandoms that I started out with when I really needed that validation were older ones, like Law & Order SVU, with Alex Cabot and Olivia Benson, played by the wonderful Mariska Hargitay. But these days, I'm much more into Legend of Korra, She-Ra Princesses of Power, anything that has queer people in it, Mass Effect, the video games by the company BioWare.
Are you writing fanfic in those?
Oh yeah, I am. Definitely.
And people can find extra of your fiction on your Patreon account, right?
Yes, they can. I'm starting a new project called The Blood Bride, and it's about an arranged marriage. There is a snow elf queen who needs magical blood to keep the thing beneath the ice asleep so her kingdom doesn't get destroyed. And so she is put in an arranged marriage with the elvish version of a country bumpkin from the forest. And said country bumpkin is not pleased about it because the snow elves killed her twin brother. So.
Ooh.
Yes, lots of drama.
Is this a like legit ice queen?
Oh yes, it is a legit ice queen.
Nice.
Both metaphorically and literally.
Love it. I love that you have a legit ice queen that's actually an ice queen. Very
cool. She also has a talking dagger. It's very sassy.
Okay. So, Elena, an ice queen is a character who starts off quite prickly and tough and guards her heart fiercely, and then through the process of love, she thaws and becomes a more personable character. So ice queen is one of the most preferred tropes in lesbian fiction at the moment. It's quite a hot topic. Okay, and TV and movies, and where are you at now, Ray?
Well, I'm very excited to see Alice Wu's new movie on Netflix, The Half of It. But her original debut movie, Saving Face, is a beautiful, beautiful love story between two Chinese-American women, told from the perspective of a Chinese-American writer and director. So, highly, highly recommend Saving Face. Cannot recommend it enough. It is not touted enough as a cornerstone of lesbian movies. And it should be.
It's on my top 10 list.
It should be.
On my top 10 list.
Well, you've always had excellent taste, Sheena. So if you have not watched Saving Face, immediately go watch it. And of course, But I'm a Cheerleader, which is about conversion therapy, but in a very funny way, as opposed to The Miseducation of Cameron Post.
Right. Okay.
You wouldn't think that a movie about conversion therapy could be funny, but it is. I promise you it is.
Okay. Elena, let's talk about you. Where are you at?
Oh, yeah, I feel like I'm kind of in my freshman year. I feel like I'm going to have to go through your website and get my graduate degree in this. But yeah.
When I have a baby, you'll be the expert.
Be the expert in something. Yeah, please know that my frame of references are very shallow. So,
you know what? This is what I always say. Don't ever be shy or embarrassed about things you love. Love away. Don't be embarrassed about love.
I could do that. So when I was, I had moved out. I was living in the rental and Kristen and I were dating. And my community was trying to figure out how do we treat Elena? How do we interact? And there was this one woman who was just so lovely, a friend from a long, long time, took me out to lunch and we were able to chat. And I realized in thinking about her that she was one of the most authentic and kind people in my life. And she was like, have you read Love Warrior? You have to read Love Warrior. And so I found it and I got it and I read it in one day. And I'm going through the pages and she's describing like how she doesn't really enjoy cuddling with her husband in their bed at night. And she's describing how distant she feels. And she's describing what it's like to like be drowning in babies and you love it and you hate it all at the same time. And I had never felt so validated by a book ever. I was like, this is my story. And she and her husband go through these marriage issues. And I'm like, oh my gosh, it's like a parallel life. And it's like 3 a.m. and I'm finishing the book and I'm sitting on the stairs because I can't even drag my butt up to bed. And I finish the book and she and her husband are sitting on a beach and they're reconciling. And that's how the book ends. And I was like, what the hell? And I threw the book away. And I was like, that's not how it ends. And then I Google her because I'd never heard of Glennon Doyle Melton ever in my whole life. And then I realized through the Googling, oh my gosh, she's married to a woman now. That was pivotal for me. It was pivotal. It was a huge moment of self-acceptance. It was a huge moment of, I am not the first one to blaze this trail. Like, people have gone before me and they've done very, very well. And I'm good. I'm okay. It was so healing and so validating. So, of course, now I follow her. But there's been other things, like even just recently, like the Netflix Feel Good with Mae Martin. That in and of itself, like watching it, that's a mind trip for me. Like, that's intense and very cool. And I love it. But then having the conversations, like recently I had a conversation with a friend, what are you watching on Netflix? Oh, I'm watching this Feel Good show. And I said, you should watch it. It's really interesting. And she says, well, why would I be into like a lesbian romance? And I responded, it just like fell out of my mouth. And I was like, I have been retranslating heterosexual romances for my entire life. Why don't you give one show a try? And once I realized that, it was like, that's so true. Like, I had always twisted plot lines and romance lines and connection lines through how would I be able to receive this, right? And so I think it's fascinating now that the mainstream population of heterosexuals are starting to realize that there's value there to retranslating art into what affects them and what touches them. I like that a lot.
That's what fandom is. That's the beauty of fandom, is that it retranslates all these things into other languages that often marginalized communities can better understand without having to read it like a second language. But at the same time, there's value in reading something as a second language and broadening your horizons, and stories at some point become universal. And that includes queer stories. That includes lesbian stories. So,
yes.
If you're heterosexual and wondering, why should I watch this lesbian story? Because they're people and you're a person, and this will help you think about yourself and your life in a new way, like any good piece of media should do.
Absolutely. Yes, that is a huge part of my evolution, I feel like, is realizing, okay, just because something is LGBTQ doesn't make it, that's not where all of its value lies, right? Just because there's another homosexual in the neighborhood doesn't mean that we're going to be best friends, right? Like, it's where the value is in the individual, because the individual is able to express universal themes that we can all relate to, regardless of what boxes we're in. I would also say, like, podcasts. I mean, it sounds trite being on a podcast and saying podcasts are so helpful. But for me, I was being a stay-at-home mom. I was carpooling 4 hours a day and doing laundry and cleaning the house, and having access to podcasts where all I had to do was type in the search engine queer, and I found Queer Empowerment, and I found Let's Hang Out, and I found the Out Entrepreneur. Like, it gave me access, like social media does, to a whole new world of validation and normalcy.
But that's the thing right there. We are not normal. The word normal,
right,
is such a crap word to use. So I use the word common. So heterosexuality just happens to be common, not normal.
Right.
The language is super important. At least it was for me in my whole coming out process, yeah, and figuring out that I wasn't actually some really random weirdo sex fiend, right?
Right. Other deviant.
Yeah, exactly. So language matters, communities matter, and representation in a positive light matters so much.
Absolutely.
I think that's great. You've been amazing, and I really appreciate your time. Elena, where can people find you online if they want to connect with you?
Oh, great. So it's funny because I'm kind of in a transition point. If you want to really connect, I am most open on Instagram under Elena Joy Experience. If you want to connect to me about public speaking, which no one's doing public speaking right now, thank you, Corona. My website right now is elenajoyexperience.com. But I am just this week launching the Pride and Joy Foundation. So you can go to prideandjoyfoundation.com. There's a preview page and a way for you to get in on the ground floor being a founding member. And then that'll have a soft launch in May and then a hard launch in June for Pride Month. So I'm super excited about supporting those families.
Fantastic. Thank you. Ray, where can people find you online?
Well, I'm easy because my name is Rady Magden everywhere. Facebook, my page is Rady Magden, RAEDMAGDON. Same on Twitter, at Rady Magden. Tumblr, Rady Magden. Website, http://radymagden.com. So, yeah, but I'm everywhere.
You have been listening to Ask a Conversion Therapy Survivor. The Ask a series is aimed at busting myths around queer topics and bringing you the realities faced by people who have actually experienced them. My name is Sheena, my pronouns are she, her, and I was joined today by two amazing guests, Elena and Ray. You can find their contact details in the show notes, should you wish to reach out to them. That's all for this episode.